Hello again. This is Andrea Schwartz with Martin Salbretti on the next installment of our podcast, Law and Liberty. And today, we're going to discuss Chapter 12 of that book by R.J. Rushdoony, entitled Law and Magic. Welcome, Martin.
Good to be here again, Andrea.
Okay, so magic. You know, is this magic that we're going to talk about, like tricks that children have done at birthday parties or the illusionists that we see on television? What are we talking about when we're talking about magic?
Well, the true magicians are very happy that that is how we understand the term. But the reality is that magic is simply the manipulation of power for the purpose of either controlling nature, man, or the supernatural. And so it's actually a much broader concept, and far from being limited to illusionists and TV shows, it's actually a pervasive element of our culture and our society.
I think a lot of people would be surprised to find out that Rushdoony said that the appeal of Satan to Eve and Adam was really an appeal to magic.
Yes, to create their own reality, use their imaginations. Nothing would be withheld from them, was the way that that was couched. Certainly in the analysis that God himself made after they had fallen, and as well as the Tower of Babel concept, which is just to build whatever your imagination tells you to build, to make reality yours, just to grip it and to control it regardless of what God had to say about it.
Do you think that the current perception of magic is intentionally perpetuated so that people won't recognize the insidious nature of it?
That's part one. Part two is tying magic to religion so that they can both be dismissed as mythical and irrelevant to our culture, the sign of a delusion, if you will. If you believe in magic, then you probably are an animist from a darker continent. But if you're a Christian, you're just basically the same thing as a magician, believing in magical powers and supernatural spirits. So that's all lumped together for the purpose of dismissing it.
And an interesting point on that, which is not exactly where he goes in this chapter, but because so much of Christendom has not embraced God's law word as authoritative and true, and that it's our job not to question it and judge it so much as it is to explore our world to see the truth of it, oftentimes people don't have a very good response to the accusation that Christian faith isn't much more than belief in magic.
Right. Their foundations are still humanistic as they approach the faith. And consequently, they're looking at it through the borrowed glasses that were offered to Adam and Eve by the serpent. That's unfortunately true even for most modern Christians. They are like fish that don't recognize the water that they need to jump out of and leap out of. They still are operating in terms of these false notions because they're culturally pervasive and they have cultural credibility. So it's very, very difficult. As Peter says, you know, those who that you no longer are with find it very strange that you no longer run with them to the same excess of riot and lasciviousness, etc. It's shocking when you get out of that system. There is a culture shock to embrace the entire biblical message, and some people can't do that very readily. It is shocking.
Well, I get letters and emails all the time from people who say that they thought they understood the faith. They thought it was actually pretty simple and that they were doing it. But when it didn't provide answers, especially as the culture got more and more distasteful to them, when they encounter a book like Law and Liberty, I can't tell you how many times people say, now I get it. The Bible really is everything it claims to be. But because, you know, I thought it was just isolated to this particular part of life, I never had any idea of the implications.
Thy commandment is exceedingly broad, as the psalmist tells us. When we abolish God's law from Christian discourse, we've essentially guaranteed turning the Bible back into a magic book, really, because God rules the world through law. And when we throw that out, God no longer rules the world except through good intentions and heart religion. And heart religion is not going to build a culture. In fact, it cannot confront a culture that's running loose on its rails. And that's the problem.
And in fact, our previous discussion on academic freedom, because so many people have been steeped in this compartmentalized view of the faith, they don't even see attacks on the Christian faith when it's hitting them broadside, you know.
If they do see it, they believe it might be a sign of the return of Christ.
Right.
So either they're oblivious to it because they don't occupy the position that God's law is important, so they don't see God's kingdom being attacked. They've essentially redefined the whole concept in such a way that we can coexist peaceably, light with darkness, having fellowship together. And I think Paul had some strong things to say about that mixture.
Right. As did Jesus. He said, not everybody who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom, but those who do the will of my Father. Okay, so let's examine some areas in which magic appears in our culture. Rushduni points out modern science, that magic is very basic to modern science. Would you expound on that a bit?
Sure. Again, it's the premise of control over nature. And he points out that there's several things that you want to do. You want to predict what's going to happen, and you want to plan the future, and you want to control nature. So this threefold aspect of science is essentially the exact same goals as magic has. In fact, Rushduni puts it very well when he says, we don't see magic in terms of the old techniques of magic that might have prevailed 3,000 years ago, but all the purposes that magic had 3,000 years ago are still alive and well in the scientific realm, the political realm, and the academic realm. So in this instance with science, it's all about experimentation and controlling all the variables so that you can get the desired result, that you can force nature to give up what you want to do. I would commend to listeners the podcast we did on law and alchemy for some background information on this. If you haven't listened to that podcast, there's some interesting insights there that talk about the control and engineering of nature. And so the premise of magic is that man's imagination is the limit, that you can go ahead and make the world you want. You can just force nature to give it up and make the world that you want. You can therefore say, we need more power, we need more this, we need less of that. And then man is regarded as limitless in his capabilities. In fact, people always hear this power of imagination, it's called, is limitless. Well, that's an idolatrous view. It's a very attractive modern viewpoint, very poetic sounding, but it is pure humanism. And we have to acknowledge that there's a time when man's imaginations were totally unrestrained and every imagination of man's heart was evil continually. And you can get back to a very similar situation unless God restrains us, unless we are actually marching according to our created purpose. Because one thing for certain, the reality that scientists are trying to control is controlled not in terms of a godly purpose, but in terms of a humanistic concept. We always say the world is your oyster, as it were. This right. is the concept. Well, the Bible says the world belongs to God, and you are just renting it, and he's going to call the rent due any time.
Exactly.
That's a whole different concept, a totally different concept. The stewardship model and the dominion model versus the totalitarian approach of science. And so modern science does, in fact, propagate itself on the premise that it is the true magic and purveyor of magic. That's why Rushduni wrote an entire book, The Mythology of Science. It goes into great detail about this concept. And one of the things that falls down in that book, and it has a great mighty fall, is the idea that science is objective. That's the pretext for scientists, that they're very objective. But Rushduni quotes from them about some results that showed that there was no life on Venus. And it says certain scientists at that time in the 60s were very saddened to hear this. That's not a scientific position. What were they hoping to find? Apparently, they operate in terms of various hopes and not in terms of a biblical idea of whatever the knowledge is that we can gain. That's the reality. Rather,
right.
man had in mind a different reality than was discovered, which means they already have a worldview that's being impressed upon the data. So there is no objectivity or neutrality in science, as there is none in any form of magic, because it's all about control, and it presupposes, one, the desirability of control, two, the possibility of it, and three, the moral necessity of it for man's own good.
Right.
So look out when scientists are coming at you with saying, we need to be able to do A, B, and C. Rushduni gives an example that I drew attention to in Mythology of Science, and it dovetails very nicely with this section of Law and Liberty, about a scientist who was talking about things like nuclear weapons, and he felt that they should be put in the hands of the scientists.
Uh-huh.
And it was objected, why would we should trust the scientist? The man became very upset says, why are we, he said, who are living for absolute truth, scientific truth, why would we do anything to hurt anybody? In other words, he assumed that they were sinless, that scientists are the ultimate class of perfect people, and therefore we should put all our cares and social needs into the hands of the scientists, social engineers, etc. And so this presupposes a total arrogance as well on the part of the scientists as they go about controlling.
A very interesting aspect of that, I think, is how the modern mainstream media is such a mouthpiece for modern science, reporting on the hopes and intents, but never really giving ample coverage to the failures and the fallacies and the falsehoods.
Yes, actually, we do have a propagandizing of scientific hopes continually. We see always the setting back of evolutionary evidence as it comes to light, and it always changes our notion of origins. I always laugh at the reported black holes that are out there. There's always a candidate of a black hole, and then it's quietly set aside later on. It appears that a bet was paid prematurely by Hawking to Kip Thorne on this point about the Cygnus X black hole, because the reality is something can simply be heavy enough that it won't let light out, and that can be done classically. We don't need Einstein's general relativity or bent space to have the escape velocity be greater than the speed of light if it's sufficiently heavy. So watch it next time around when they talk about these candidates for black holes or other such things. There is a hope that the whole universe, they'll say there must be a big black hole at the center of this galaxy. And so a hope, a worldview concerning general relativity and Einstein's truthfulness is actually at play more than objective evidence.
Right.
Because you could have the same phenomenon, a super heavy star that doesn't curve space, because curved space may not be the cause of gravity. In fact, it's likely not to be.
And because the education of science is always so convoluted, you'll have people basically ceding all sorts of credibility to the scientists with the expression, well, I'm not smart enough to understand it. And of course they'd be right because they understand all those numbers, not taking into account that those who disagree with them are rarely given airtime.
Yeah, we see this with the climate control debate. Can mankind, or do we have what's called anthropogenic climate change? They don't even call it global warming anymore. It's called climate change because no one knows what direction it's going to go. How do we know that the existing climate's perfect? We seem to have set that as the mark. But yes, it is true that, in fact, it's one of the few cases where the Wikipedia pages were reportedly being controlled so that contrary evidence was being blocked continually. Because apparently one position was supposed to hold sway. It's funny, when we talk about science, we're back at the academic freedom debate from our last podcast.
Right.
But this is because these magicians are at war with each other. And so the main concept, again, is that of control. And this kind of blends to the question of politics, because if in science, the only way to guarantee the outcome of an experiment is to control all the factors. Then by implication in the social realm, if you're trying to create a social situation or a cultural result, you also need to control all the factors, which presupposes totalitarian control of the populace. Therefore, Marxism and communism were very clear that they were scientific approaches to the social question. They were, in essence, the true form of magic to create a new culture that man imagines simply by fiat. If God can say fiat looks, let there be light, so we can say fiat paradise, let there be a worker's paradise. The reality is, every time, as Rushdoony says, that mankind tries to bring heaven on earth on his own strength, he always creates a hell on earth.
Right, right. And today you have people who will defend the fact, Christians, that the Bible is not a science book. The Bible is not a science book. And instead of then saying, answering the question, well, then where you're going to get your basis for how to view anything, they have compartmentalized the faith that it's over here, and then what we have is science over here, and apparently never the twain shall meet.
That's due to the influence of Bernard Rahm's book, Science and Scripture, in that we're living with the aftermath of those kind of compromising ideas. There's no other way to put them. I regret to have to say it, but it needs to be said that we've given away points for probably four centuries and counting at this point in time. And there's no reason for it except that we have a lust for credibility. We do not want to be laughed at or mocked or scorned. And we are no different than Peter, who denied he knew Jesus when confronted with his Galilean accent while Christ was on trial. We just don't want to be worried about that. Or like those who are feared to stand up for Christ knowing they'd be thrown out of the synagogues. So this lust for credibility is simply sapping all Christian strength and moral fiber. And until we say we are willing to uphold Christ and his word at all cost, considering what he's done for us, then we'll gain some ground. Then we will actually become a formidable group because we will stand unconditionally on our faith. But as long as we stand conditionally on our faith, that means that there's something more powerful than God in our minds and in our hearts, and that will actually be the operative principle that will determine the outcomes of our lives.
Right. I'm reminded of in the book of Samuel when Israel was clamoring for a king because they didn't like the fact that they weren't like the other nations. I think today we have Christians that cede so much of the benefit we have, having God as our king, God as our ultimate lawgiver, that we actually have gained all those curses that come with choosing man over God.
It is exactly as God said it would be.
Okay, another important area where magic prevails today, according to Rushdoony, is art. Modern art, he points out, isn't modern at all. He calls it the revival of one of the oldest systems for getting power. How does art gain power?
Well, art gains power primarily because of the authority we repose in the artist, because the artist believes in the regenerating power of the aesthetic experience. This is something that Rushdoony talks about in the biblical philosophy of history, among other places. And it simply means that the artist is, just like the scientist, a member of a new elite. And therefore, that power comes through art to remake the world. Some composers saw it this way. Scriabin, Alexander Scriabin was a Russian composer, died in 1915. He was born on Christmas Day and thought he was another Messiah, better than the first one, because he would actually get the job done that Jesus failed to do. Huh. And he had mapped out a piece called Mysterium that would begin with bells suspended by balloons over the Himalayas and end up 7 days later with the general elevation and exaltation of all mankind. So they believe in the regenerating power of the artistic experience. We see this, I just listened a few years back, maybe many years back, to when Mario Giallini was the conductor of the Los Angeles Philharmonic, and they threw him on the TV and he was being interviewed. And what he says is, what the world needs is Brahms. There you go. That's it right there. The power to renew the world is through Johannes Brahms' music. What the world needs is Brahms.
Huh.
A variation, I guess, on the Beatles notion, but what the world needs is Christ and his law.
Exactly.
That's the reality. So the substitution of an aesthetic experience as if that can purge us of our evils and make us wise, I think it's credited to Kipling, music hath charms that calm the savage beast, as if it was that the musical experience could do this. The 6th century Hellenist philosopher Boethius held, again, that music had the power to shape men's souls and therefore was a very serious business to be a musician. It had all sorts of implications culturally. In the visual arts, we had the same concept that's being placed. Rushdoony quotes the Russian Vasily Kandinsky and Picasso in terms of their call that they saw themselves as the elite and the rest as the unwashed masses. The scum of the earth, that's how they looked down on people because they were so much better being artists. We saw Beethoven, again, the cult around the artist as an individual, autonomous champion of freedom, doing this very, very similar things.
But you can't deny the fact that music and art have a great influence on a people. So what's the alternative to this magic that permeates the arts? What's the biblical position on art and music and things regarding that?
Well, first thing is that all music is derivative. The greatest art in music was doubtless that created by Johann Sebastian Bach, who dedicated every single work that he did to God. And this was hardly a barrier or an obstacle to his imagination. It unleashed him because he operated in terms of a lawful presupposition. But modern art hates to be bound by anything. we talk more about breaking new boundaries and breaking new ground rather than operating in terms of an existing style. It's because revolution is more important in the mind of the artist. He's always breaking standards because that's what he is. He is an iconoclast, a breaker of images. And so the history, our perceived cultural inheritance, is something to be abolished. I was interviewed by Kevin Swanson on his Generations radio program just a few weeks back, and we got on the topic of the destruction of the legacy of modern music so that we can give way to new musicians, because the new is more important than any legacy of the past which we would rebound. So throw out Bach, throw out Beethoven. This is actually advocated by Christopher Small, an English musicologist, in his book that I gave the references for in my article, which is available online. And it's scary to the extent to which they believe that we can shuffle the deck in terms of recreating our society in terms of these artistic expressions. In fact, let me just tell you this about Small.
Okay.
He directly attacks Genesis 1:26-28. He refers in his book throughout to the artifice, the myth of this dominion mandate that has to be abolished and thrown out because music is not naturally built according to this dominion mandate. Therefore, Bach, who did do this, has to be abolished. He promotes the music of Claude Debussy, a French expressionist, because Debussy's music is purely existential. There is no hierarchy or dominion in it. It just exists for the existential moment and suspends time and leaves the listener in kind of a gauzy veil of shifting nebulous harmonies. And so he says we need to get that music of Debussy implanted in terms of a more pagan notion. And therefore you can have a pagan revolution through a shift in music by getting rid of the Bach and promoting stuff more like Debussy. So here again, we're seeing art, music in this instance, being used as the lever for social control.
Well, you have to explain, I think, to give people a sense of that, what makes Bach's music more in line with a biblical worldview than the others that you mentioned?
Well, first off, it's the acknowledgement of the one in the many. That is, there's diversity with all these various voices, but each voice has its own integrity. These are various lines that are going. We all talk about around like row, row, row your boat, things on this order, or Frère Jacques. A fugue is an extremely elaborate form of this, where a theme, a musical idea, is laid over itself several times, and it's an extended exposition of the possibilities inside these tones. In other words, he was an artisan who was able to take a look at a theme and determine all the possible things that could be done with it. And then he ran with that ball and he took dominion over that theme so that he could even do something exhaustively. That's what his great masterwork, The Art of the Fugue, was an exhaustive exposition of how to do this, how to take dominion over music. And as I pointed out in the radio program, The Art of the Fugue by Bach is regarded as one of the two highest achievements of the human mind. And it was done by a self-conscious Christian, a Lutheran, who was an Orthodox person who enjoyed dry, fuddy-duddy theology.
So as contrasted to that, today's music is pushing a random, non-structured aspect, kind of paralleling a chaotic origin of man in the universe?
It essentially is the outworking of the notion that man is in charge. Therefore, it proceeds on an autonomous basis, and the purpose then can be simply raw enjoyment. But if it gets anywhere near theoretical, say it's a PhD dissertation work from a modern conservatory or a university, it's going to be something that's going to be relatively unpleasant for the average person to listen to. Because, for example, it might be atonal, not harbor any tonal centers by design. So, because that's the way modern music is written. It supposedly has evolved away from Bach into new atonal dissonant channels, and the uglier the better in some respects, because again, it's painting the mustache on the Mona Lisa in effect. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not saying there's a lot of work that goes into it, but what is the purpose for all of this? What does it achieve?
So you're saying the foundations have, where something comes from, somebody's starting point has a great bearing on what they produce.
Correct. Yeah, I went into some detail on the other radio program, and I don't think this is the place to do it, because we're talking about magic. The main point to see here is that certain people will take the music materials and want to change society with them. And others, like Bach, will take those same materials and do something very, very different and give something back to God that subsequent generations say, wow, that's astonishing. This stuff stands the test of time.
Right.
And why? Because it was all driven by self-conscious acknowledgement that God was the author of all the hierarchy and the tonal structures.
So in other words, Bach was thinking God's thoughts after him, and modern music and art is rebellious acts against God trying to destroy God's creation.
In essence, it's a bit of a simplification, but those premises are true.
Okay.
And we can, and I've gone out of my way to document this over the years in quite a few journal articles at Calcedon.
Right. The most recent one that you're referring to is available at calcedon.edu. And if you do a search for Martin Celbretti and subject of Bach, you'll find it. Okay, let's cover one last area in terms of a modern dedication to magic, and Rushduni calls modern education that falls into that category. How so?
Now, remember, one of the three things that magic is to control is either to control nature, the supernatural, or man himself. And so here it is that man takes control of man, which really means one man taking control of another man, or in this instance, a bunch of men and women taking control of a bunch of children that the parents have forfeited their oversight over. That's the scary part, that Christians would willingly turn their children over into a system that's designed to reshape those children as humanists. That's the only guaranteed result.
Right.
And therefore, the idea is that if we can control the children, we control the future. So that's why control of children is such an important part of magic in this sense, in the sense of power over the planet, to predict, plan, and to control. That's why places like Germany will not allow homeschooling. That's why for several, I know in the 80s, Rushduni had mentioned on the Easy Chair tapes that there were discussions and very close votes in Parliament in England about abolishing all Christian schools so that every student gets to have that exact same high-quality education in a state school. And the very fact that those things can even come to votes is a scary thought.
Right, especially when the educational system, despite what we hear, doesn't produce people who can think and reason. It often produces people who will take shortcuts and falsify outcomes that don't match their original hopes.
Right. Perhaps you were aware of some of this going on in California in the 80s about good old Supervisor Bill Honig.
Right.
And making the comment regarding homeschooling conventions, as he kept a wary eye on them, that so long as it stayed small, he could probably tolerate it, but if it got significant, he would have to essentially quash it, take steps.
Right, which he attempted to do, and it backfired on him because, thanks to a lot of dedicated people at the Family Protection Ministries locally in California and Homeschool Legal Defense, they stood on God's word enough to say that the people of God won't stand for that.
Right. Here's the whole point, is that when we talk about magic, magic is a kind of an extension of the realm of possibility. Magic says, maybe this is possible. Maybe nothing's impossible. If man can dream it, we can go ahead and come up with it. The problem is that man's dreams are not clean, white, pure, and driven as the snow. Rather, man's dreams are continually to be his own God and to make a society that he sees fit to make. And unfortunately, he's God's creature, and any such result of rebellion against God always ends up being a hellhole. So, and that's where the magic impulse, this impulse to control, comes in, because we believe in the power of possibility. It was kind of unfortunate that we've had some folks ostensibly in the Christian camp talk about possibility thinking when that's what we should be talking about is law thinking.
Exactly.
In terms of Torah thinking and justice shalt thou do thinking from Deuteronomy 16:20 versus just let your imaginations run loose. And that's the whole point, is that imaginations running loose is the whole point of abandonment of righteousness and justice. So Rushduni is very, very right. He says when we have these things going on in a culture, I like his wording, he says we have a collision course, a collision between God's purpose and judgment and between the various magicians.
Right. And for those who are listening and feel a little overwhelmed at some aspects of the discussion, I know when I first encountered this material, it was easy to say it was over my head, or I couldn't possibly ever learn this enough to be able to explain it to someone else. Let me assure you that as you learn about law and its relationship to liberty and is the only precursor to liberty, that you'll discover that all those things that you thought were true or should be true that others have told you didn't make sense will come together, and that you'll have a better approach to understanding the things around you. I saw that manifested in my own children who, because they were not spoon-fed a lot of the lies in terms of history and science, etc., they still had the ability to reason and look at things from a scriptural point of view. So don't be dismayed. It's a progressive learning, and there are ample materials and articles available at the Chalcedon website to help you do just that, not to mention the enormous library of tape lectures by R.J. Rushdoony.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, we have come to the end of our time. Thank you, Martin, once again for a very enlightening conversation. For those of you who enjoy this, we encourage you to pass it along to others and to have people begin to identify the need for Christians once again to uphold God's law as our only true hope for the future. See you next time.